It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley are here. The big debate is on. Did Microsoft antitrust action against Microsoft in the 90s pave the way for Google? And is it time for Google to suffer the same fate? Paul and Mary Jo battle it out. Plus, we'll talk about Redstone 5 and why you can't get it. And a whole lot more coming up next on Windows Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley, episode 558, recorded February 21st, 2018. 150 bottles of ranch dressing on the wall. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/windows. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Microsoft with two of the preeminent Windows Microsoft journalists, two of the tops, the author of the Windows Vista Secrets, the Delphi 3 Super Bible.
A highlight and a low light right there, right next to each other.
Mr. Paul Thurrott, thurrott.com for his current efforts. Actually, leanpub.com for his latest book, The Windows 10 Field Guide. So nice to have you back, Paul.
Leo, this is just a weird coincidence, but that Vista Secrets book actually ties into the first story we're talking about, and the Windows 10 Field Guide ties into a story that's later in the show.
It's an amazing thing. I'm a clairvoyant.
It's weird, but it's
incredible.
True.
And that jolly chortle on your right, that comes from Mary Jo Foley. She is in charge of chortles at allaboutmicrosoft.com, which is a ZDNet blog. And she has.
Do you have my book, by the way?
What?
I wrote one book. Not
getting
many
it right now. What was the name
one
of
book the book so far, you mean?
It's one book forever. Microsoft 2.0. It's
old
yes. now.
It's I do
like
have that.
10 years old now, but.
I do have that. I think it's at home. I
it
got
also
that
figures into first story today.
Wow. Yes, it
That's
does.
That's right. Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
You two couldn't be better to talk about our first story today. How Microsoft plans to stay relevant in the post-Gates era. It was prescient. My God, they're flying off the shelves. Only one left in stock. Order soon.
Woo, get it now.
Get it now.
Did you ever read the audiobook version of it?
I did not.
I should have. That would have been interesting.
Maybe that's what I think I might have the Audible, actually, come to think of it. That's probably what I have. In any event, I'm ordering it now because I really do want to have that.
It's no 1,000 pager like the Delphi Bible, but.
Well, but you can bet Bill Gates read it right after he read the new Steven Pinker book.
You know, it is kind of a sad statement of my life that I have spent a good part of the past 25 years documenting the undocumentable. And we'll get into that later because that literally is part of the story. Mm-hmm. From some of the Windows 10 stuff.
Well, your top story is one that caught my eye this morning. In fact, I got up around 5 in the morning to read this and finished just before the show today. It's a fairly long article from the New York Times Magazine. I think it's this Sunday's, right?
Yeah, it must have been in the Sunday paper because it's a long form article. It was probably in the magazine or whatever.
Well, I think it's coming in the magazine is what I'm thinking. Oh. I'm not.
Okay.
It's confusing.
Plus or minus one Sunday.
Yeah.
They always do that.
Yeah. The case against the New York Times. Actually, the case against the Google, and your headline is the case against New York Times, the case against Google.
Just as kind of a preamble on this one. I read the New York Times every day and I hate it. I hate it. And it is probably the best newspaper in the United States, and they drive me insane. And they're
you
wrong.
You and the president, I must say. You're right in
there. No, for different reasons. They will publish anything about health and nutrition, regardless of what stance it takes. They're ludicrous.
But they published Gary Taubes along with all the others.
Yeah, right? And then they publish nonsense right next to it. It's unbelievable. Like, all you need is a doctor to cite a study, and they have a story. And they don't care if it contradicts
all
what they wrote yesterday.
All the news that fits, Paul.
Yeah, well, apparently there's a bottomless pit of area there because they will publish anything.
Yeah.
Well, so they know when it comes to tech, though, increasingly, I find them to be infuriating. And there are a lot of reasons for this, but I think the one everyone here will at least understand is the fact that they basically ignore Microsoft all the time. And it is astonishing when they can cover topics where Microsoft is a central player and either mention them in passing or not mention them at all. It makes me insane. So I saw this article and I thought, obviously, Google is and should be at the center of antitrust investigations around the world for obvious reasons. There's no doubt about it. They don't really have any issues right here in the United States right now. They have at least three cases pending in Europe, as probably most people understand. But their ability to impact the world is so much greater than Microsoft's was when all they did was control the PC. It's an order of magnitude bigger. When Microsoft had their antitrust problems in the late 90s, early 2000s in the United States, they had some low hundreds of millions of users. Google has like 5 billion users on the web. It's some crazy number. It's not even close.
This article is by Charles Duhigg. He wrote a book called Smarter, Faster, Better, and the Power of Habit. And his most recent article in the New York Times was The Economic Lessons of the Fidget Spinner. So he's well qualified in this topic. I thought actually it was a very good article.
Oh, no, by the way, it probably is. But I've set it aside in pocket to really kind of go through it again. I'm interested in this topic. I don't think that the broader Google story here has much relevance for our audience per se, but obviously when you read anything about Google and antitrust, at least from my perspective, one of the first things that comes to mind is Microsoft. So I was fascinated to see this guy go off on a multi-page spiel about Standard Oil again, like that was the most recent case, but he eventually does get to Microsoft.
Well, Standard Oil, he actually compares Google to Standard Oil, which was broken up, as you know, into dozens of companies, because he says Google's market share is approaching that of Standard Oil, and they're doing, he says, I thought it was very interesting, he says that really, if you look at monopolies, at least in our era, they're all because of a technological advance that one company owned, and no other company could duplicate, and then once these companies gain monopoly market share, they acted very effectively to keep other companies out of the market.
Microsoft perfected this in 1999. but again, you know, as far as Google goes, there's no doubt that Google abuses their monopolist power. There's no doubt about it. And this article is a great example of it.
They use who wrote a shopping engine that essentially, as soon as it started becoming successful,
Google caught wind of what they were doing,
it disappeared from Google search results. And they've spent the last decade trying to find some remedy. The U.S. has ignored them. That's that famous FTC case study that was accidentally published in the Wall Street Journal. The political heads of the FTC decided not to pursue Google. But the EU, Margaret Vestager, did in fact, and in fact that this case was one of the reasons that they levied a record $2.7 billion fine against Google. So they have found some measure of success in the EU. And he makes a really interesting point, which we have talked about before, which is that antitrust actions in the U.S. are very different than antitrust actions in Europe. In the U.S., they're trying to protect consumers. In Europe, they're trying to protect competition and essentially companies. So I just wanted to give people I know you're going to focus on this Microsoft part of it, some people kind of the lay of the land here.
The Google stuff to me is obvious. I don't – and as far as protecting consumers versus competitors go, the end game there is the same, right? When you give consumers choice and they can make their own choice and they have the right choices, they can do what they will, that will impact competition, right? I mean, fair competition, whatever. The thing that always will bother me about Google is that they claim that their search results are organic when in fact they're highly contrived. And they've often pushed their own services to the front and disadvantaged competitors. Whatever. Okay, so I think we all understand how that works. Of course, now they compare it to Microsoft. I would say that there are two big antitrust cases in the technology world that should have some bearing on Google. And one is Intel, which also ran afoul of antitrust regulators in Europe. And the other one was Microsoft, which ran into antitrust troubles in the United States, in Europe, in South Korea, and I think in other places too. Google, Microsoft back in the late 90s, early 2000s decided to fight. And Intel, based on Microsoft's experience, decided to settle. And you don't hear anything else about that. That just kind of came and went. Microsoft's problems were what I call the lost decade.
We launched Tech TV right at the beginning of that DOJ suit in 1998, really? And it hadn't ended when Tech TV ended 6 years later.
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And who can forget that image of Bill Gates in a deposition just gulping his way through?
I think I told you this. I don't have them anymore, but you could get them for free, and I did. I got the entire videotape set of his depositions. It is
the box set.
Most miserable watching you can
painful.
Imagine. It is awful. It's awful. I think I've talked about that a little bit before, but the thing, there's a lot of stuff that's interesting about Microsoft and antitrust. I think for Mary Jo and I think it's fair to say that it required us to learn a lot about a topic that we don't normally care about just to understand what was going on with this company that we cover. And I think on the flip side, for people who are interested in law or antitrust specifically, this case required them to learn about technology and how Microsoft was using kind of age-old practices to take the same competitive advantage using modern technology. Anyway, the article about Google does a little brief flyby of what happened to Microsoft.
Makes a kind of an interesting point, I thought.
Yeah, which I completely disagree with.
Okay.
Which is that what eventually humbled Bill Gates and ended up Microsoft's monopoly wasn't antitrust prosecutions, observers say, whoever they are, but a more nimble startup named Google. In other words, it wasn't antitrust that caused Microsoft to fall from the top of the heap. It was Google.
Well, we've talked about the penalties that were levied on them and how it took so long that they were too late really to make a difference. But Duhigg in the article makes the point that because everybody was hyper aware of this antitrust prosecution, everybody's looking over their shoulders and really for a long time before it was even resolved, trying to avoid monopolistic behavior. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason it worked.
Okay, but I mean, the notion that the government doesn't need to worry about antitrust because no online giant will ever survive longer than it deserves to is, I don't know, provably false, but the Microsoft case does not prove that. And I think Mary Jo would agree
with this. Part of this is that Duhigg is a little confusing in his theories because he sets some straw men up and then knocks them down.
And yeah, he kind of goes back and forth throughout the thing, and you're like,
what do you believe, Charles?
The example he uses is ludicrous. The two dropouts who created Google introduced a series of applications, Google Docs and Google Sheets, that eventually began to compete with almost every aspect of Microsoft businesses. No, it didn't. It's fair to say that they compete, but this is perhaps the most lopsided part of the Microsoft-Google competition imaginable. I just wrote about this. Google, that part of Google's business earned approximately 10% of the revenues of Office 365 using the most recent data. It's not even close.
Yeah.
This is not why Microsoft fell apart and Google rose to ascendancy. I mean, there are certain market trends that were occurring toward mobile and web and the cloud eventually, obviously. Mm-hmm. It was not just Google, by the way. It was also a little company called Apple you may have heard of that played kind of a role in here.
Yeah,
but right. But I think the big thing from my perspective, just watching this from the outside, is that Microsoft, contrary to what Bill Gates said at the time, was very much distracted by this antitrust stuff. And they were unable to compete effectively for about 10 years. And I'm not saying they would have won. I don't mean to suggest that there's like an alternate history here where Microsoft comes out ahead at the end of all this. Mm. But if Microsoft hadn't been hit between the legs twice but by huge antitrust cases, there's no doubt that it could have responded better to both Google and Apple.
I think that's the
and
point.
It's, he's saying it's a little unfair.
That the hobbling of Microsoft allowed Google to exist and that now it's time to hobble Google so that the next thing can come along, right?
Well, that's a tough one too. It's hard because – and Mary Jo should jump in here at some point. I don't mean to dominate this, but – it's hard because of the passage of time to overstate how badly Microsoft needed to be broken up in the early 2000s, how awful that company was, and how unbelievably unfair they were within the markets they competed in. And when I look at the way that they were and the way they did things, the way that they practiced business at that time, and I still believe this today, I felt that they should have been broken up. When I look at Google today, I see two things. One, much bigger company with much broader exposure and access to consumers than Microsoft ever had. And they're doing exactly the same thing, just with different types of products. And, you know, does that mean that that Google should be broken up today? I got to say, I'm a little older now and I kind of don't care anymore. But, you know, I was much more invested in the Microsoft stuff, say, in 2000, 2001 than I am in Google in 2018. But you could make a pretty good case for it. And I don't think this article makes that case at all. I think that they try to make the opposite case.
Yeah, that's the problem with this article is I felt like I knew where he was going with the argument when I started reading it. And then I'm like, he's not arguing what I thought he was going to argue. And by the end, I'm like, maybe he is arguing what I thought he was going to argue. I actually went back after I read this article and looked back at some of the things I wrote because I actually was in the court for part of the Microsoft trial in the late 90s. And I think it's hard to remember this now. It feels like such ancient history, but I mean, this case was all consuming for Microsoft. And I think a lot of people now are like, yeah, okay, they got a little slap on the wrist and it didn't really do much. I actually went back and looked at what happened to them when they lost. And I found this document about what kind of sanctions were imposed on them. It said more than 400 Microsoft employees and staff are involved in the work on making public the APIs and the technical documentation. 400 people for 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And like you said, they always were looking over their shoulder after that. And that's why they didn't tie a lot of products together until recently that they might have naturally tied together earlier. So something like Microsoft 365, right, which has Windows and Office and Intune all tied together. During the period when Microsoft was going through all of this antitrust stuff and the 10 years after, they never would have dared to do that, right? Because everybody would have said, oh, watch out, here comes the DOJ again. So a lot of products and services at Microsoft that had these natural synergies, they had to keep them separate, or at least they believed they had to keep them separate to avoid going up against the DOJ and antitrust regulators and other places too again. So, yeah, I feel like the article oversimplified a bit, like just how chilling an effect this DOJ case was on how Microsoft did business.
And just, I mean, think of some specific things. We know that Jim Altchin, for example, infamously had a terrible stand moment where a doctored video appeared that didn't show what he was trying to show. And someone had just made a mistake when they edited it. He looked like a jerk. That guy eventually took over all of Windows on the client and server and then was basically booted out of the company after Windows Vista finally shipped, which is the thing I was talking about with the book. The development of Windows Vista was this 8-year-long disaster where they couldn't get anything out the door. They had to keep re-releasing different versions of Windows XP to kind of make up the slack because they'd gotten completely thrown off their 3-year Windows development cycle.
Yeah,
this is all related to the same exact thing. It's all related to the antitrust.
I think the part that we both objected to the most in the article was just kind of the throwaway statement that, and by the way, it was Google that humbled Microsoft.
Yeah, Google ended Microsoft, you know. There's a thing, you know, tied to what you were saying about product bundling and so forth. Product bundling is perfectly legal until you have monopoly, right?
Right.
And this creates a situation where Microsoft at the time was not able to bundle products together, but all of its competitors could. Because Microsoft was the only one with a monopoly. You get into a situation today where nobody really considers the implications of you buy a Mac and you just get all the Apple word processing and spreadsheet software for free. Like nobody really cares. You know, this is that's nothing. You know, Google gives away this stuff on the web for free. All you have to do is sign up for a free Gmail account. You get all this stuff for free. Nobody complains about that.
Yeah. And Microsoft is still the monopoly player in operating systems on the desktop. Not overall, but in the desktop, they still are.
It's minority platform.
Right.
Well, it's not because the way that we compute today is a much bigger thing, and PCs are only a small.
Well, but also it's not illegal to be a monopoly. That's kind of important to understand. It's illegal to use your monopoly to keep other to enter new areas. To keep others from competing with you. And so that's what Google has been doing. Google, to understand this, you have to understand that what Google's real business is advertising, that the search facilitates advertising. And the example that Duhigg uses in the article is this couple who created something Google was not very good at, which is vertical search for shopping. That is finding, you know, white tennis shoes at a, you know, with free shipping under $50. Google's not so good at that. But Google, instead of competing, basically put because they owned search, you know, they controlled search, were able to put these guys out of business just by hiding them, just by not favoring them. And then, and of course, that's what they're in trouble in the EU for, is favoring Google's shopping results over others. And Google makes a lot of money. Google's claim, you know, putting these answers up first. Google claims with some merit, this is what people want. When they go to a search engine, they don't want a link to another search engine. When they want the when they ask for the weather from Google, they want the weather, not a link to a weather site.
Well, but they also want the right answer. And you know, if Google were to evolve its products in such a way that it becomes kind of an answer engine, which by the way it has, then that works out fine. But this happened in the interim when they didn't have any vertical search capabilities, and you couldn't ask it nuanced questions of any kind that were specific to you or your
situation. Was Microsoft pursuing Bing at this time? I mean, in other words, if Google hadn't come along, could Bing have been dominant?
I'm trying to think back. 1999? I don't know.
Yeah. So Mary Jo, when we spoke about this offline, she raised an interesting point, because there's two sides to this Microsoft coin, right? So there's the antitrust stuff, which, like I said, just set them off course. They went flying off into the woods. But the other half of that, you got to, and this is the point she raised, and maybe she should talk about this, is just that they were also kind of fat and happy. They were so used to winning, they had stopped trying.
Yeah.
And this you can see this in things that seem small today. But if you think about the late 1990s, Bill Gates puts out a book called The Road Ahead, where he only mentions the internet in passing like two or three times or whatever it was. They didn't see this coming, you know? And there were people at Microsoft who were writing memos to Bill Gates saying, you got to get on this. Netscape is happening. Mosaic is happening. The World Wide Web is happening. This is the next platform. We got to get on this. And they didn't see it, because when you get into this position of power, you're just so used to having won everything. You know, they beat WordPerfect. They beat Borland. They beat everybody, the Lotus, whatever. Yeah. Whatever all these battles were in the past, they were along behind them. They were winning everything.
Yeah. I think this is where the parallel is. Yeah, this is where the parallel is with Google, right? Like, the why did Microsoft win everything? Because of the way they went about it, right? They, if you look back at what got them in trouble with the DOJ, they had these marketing agreements that they imposed on OEMs, and they said, hey, if you don't carry any of our competitors' products, we'll give you a cheaper price per copy of Windows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure.
And if you do, then we're going to, like, hold your feet to the fire, and we're going to make you pay a lot more money. And, you know, Google's in that same position now where they can do that.
Yeah, two things to that. One is the speed at which their abuse can happen is so much faster today than it was with Microsoft, because everything gets sped up. Microsoft had this kind of impact on the industry that was very real, where they would kind of turn their evil eye of Sauron on some business and say, yeah, we're going to go do that thing, even though they had nothing ready. And they could destroy companies, and they did.
Yeah.
They also did things. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. And Microsoft, just like Google is saying at the time, also said it was for the good of consumers, right? They said,
Of course
consumers want us to make Windows cheaper. Of course they want Internet Explorer bundled for free with Windows. It's better for them. And Google's making this argument with search engines now, right? They're saying consumers want to do a search and get one answer. They don't want to have all these confusing options, right? They want to have one. I do a search, I get the answer I want. Microsoft said, customers want to go to a shop, buy a PC, and have everything already preloaded from us on that PC.
Both are demonstrably true. People who think,
both are demonstrably true. And I think that this is why the EU, at least with Google, has been more successful, because they're not trying to protect consumers. Again, this comes back to different interpretations of what antitrust is for. They're trying to protect competition.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, ultimately, even in Microsoft's case, the EU was more effective, right? There was a shiny moment there where Thomas Penfield Jackson was going to split this company in half or whatever, and he screwed up. He was a terrible human being, but you know, the well, he just was. I mean, he, you know, he He behaved illegally in his own way.
He was the judge in the case in the U.S.
He was.
Yeah. And he hated Microsoft with a burning passion. God, I miss that guy. Anyway, so you know, he was a jerk. But the EU succeeded in ways that the United States didn't when it comes to antitrust. And that was true with Microsoft. And it's true with Google, although you know Google has never actually faced an antitrust trial in the United States.
Probably for that reason. Right. I mean, that's what, at least that's what Duhigg's thesis is that the FTC abandoned pursuing Google where the EU didn't because the FTC said, well, there's no harm to consumers. This benefits consumers.
I think that's a lack Google's of imagination argument on their part. Right. And I think that governments move too slowly to
also,
keep up with
and Duhigg brings this up, there's also in this century been kind of the thinking among technologists that technology moves so fast that antitrust regulation is too slow. It's ineffective. They use Microsoft as an example. Mm-hmm. And if you just let technologies emerge, they will, by their very nature, disrupt the incumbents. And there is some evidence for that, too. Frankly,
maybe, but I honestly, I we don't know. There's no way to know what could have happened, right? We can play what if games all day long, but imagine if Microsoft, unbridled by any antitrust concerns, was able to react and shut down this tiny company called Google right when they started, or a research in Apple who was so cash poor they needed like $150 million for some, you know, to succeed, you know, just to last the year.
You could argue that the reason Microsoft gave Apple $150 million is because they needed competition. Otherwise,
a lot of people say that.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. But that's the point. They were so powerful compared to Apple then that they could keep Apple on life support in a high profile public way, and it was fine. You know, like, I mean, obviously the tables have turned, and that's very interesting. But you know, could Apple and Google specifically have become so powerful in such a short period of time if Microsoft had the full power of its own capabilities? I think the answer is no. It doesn't mean that things would have been completely different. It might have still ended up here. It might have taken longer or whatever. But
so you would agree with the thesis then that the antitrust actions against Microsoft were a good idea and had a beneficent effect. It allowed Google and others to emerge.
Boy,
I do, for sure.
Yeah,
do, but there's a big but to that, and this is something. Look, we can apply this to NFL rules. We can just apply it to life in general. What happened to Microsoft, I guess, was fair, but we need to apply those same rules to everyone else. You know, if we can sit here and agree that what happened to Microsoft was the right thing, then why we need to be openly wondering why Google is not facing this exact thing right now in the United States. It makes no sense.
I think I have to say, I think that this article is one of many now that are demonstrating a move in that direction. And there, who wrote that book? The was it called The Big Four? Professor from NYU who says it's time. It's going to happen. It's going to happen soon. That the Big Four are going to face government regulation because they've just gotten too big. Facebook, Google, Amazon.
I mean, the internet, there's a great argument for making it a utility, essentially. It should be like electricity. It should be
It's all thrown into disarray, though, by the current disarray in Washington. That's the problem.
Oh, yeah.
We're in a kind of unpredictable situation right now.
Well, that's for sure.
And then also there is the point to be made that we can never know what would have happened had Microsoft not been prosecuted.
Of course.
We can't know.
No, that's right. Absolutely right. But we do have ample precedent for how they behaved in the past, you know, and things would not have gone well.
But you don't want to make this some sort of moralizing. You don't want to say, well, they're bad. We have to prosecute. It's not a criminal offense here. We're not talking about them committing crimes. We're talking about doing something for society that's economically sensible. And it's difficult to prove it one way or the other.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are moral issues for sure. But it's interesting to me because you can look at this and see it very clearly with both Apple and Microsoft. I can't say that I've ever seen this with Google. Maybe you'll have an example of this for Google. But these are companies that rose to power and then kept acting like they were some kind of a little startup or a scrappy newcomer. And and that behavior, which is absolutely fine when you have some kind of minority market share, is completely illegal when you have monopoly. Apple has never hit what I would call a traditional monopoly. But you see in their behavior, and even Steve Jobs admitted to this, you know, that they kind of overdid the – you know, we're the scrappy upstart thing.
Yeah, well, but when after you have 4% were... market share, it doesn't, you can, you make it. But here's the modern example, Uber, which had to be scrappy and feisty when they were, you know, fighting all the different taxi commissions, but took that attitude way too far and as a result damaged themselves severely.
Yeah, and by the way, that's...
The other variable, too, is who runs these companies at the time when these things happen, right? So if Satya Nadella had been running Microsoft when they were a monopoly, would it have been a very different company? Yes, I think.
But Satya Nadella never could have run that company then because he never would have been elevated to that position.
No, but Bill Gates was like as cantankerous as they come at
that
time.
He's like the kindly old grandfather guy who's handing out money to the poor people while he solves malaria or whatever. But the truth is... That guy was terrible.
Ruthless. I mean,
he was awful.
Ruthless.
And and we kind of forget that because he seems so benign right now. But he was an amazing competitor and ruthless, like you said. I don't know.
He was the man Microsoft needed at the time. I mean, you could say that John D. Rockefeller was ruthless. That's how Standard Oil got to where
it was. But this is the MacArthur thing all over again, right? You do need them at a certain point in time. But they tend to stay past their useful age. And, you know, this happened maybe arguably with Ballmer. I agree with you that Satya Nadella would never have allowed that kind of abuse to happen. But he
would never have been CEO. No, you're right.
Yep. Yeah, not at that time. He wouldn't have.
Microsoft needed Bill Gates. And look, I mean, Ballmer, I think Ballmer was forged in the mold of Bill Gates, but not as effective as Bill. Not maybe as smart as Bill.
Steve Ballmer this company. Yeah. We're going to continue what worked before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you choose me, it's like we're getting more.
He's the double down.
What you're really getting is a watered down version.
Watered down, double down.
Yep.
So I, you know, my inclination would be to say, well, we just don't have any data to show whether in this era the natural business cycle will be beneficent, will work, and that these big companies will rise and then fall in the normal course of events. The real problem is I don't think we have the luxury to experiment.
I know.
Because by the time we find out, oh, that doesn't work, Google, Facebook, Microsoft will be too big. It'll be over. Amazon.
No, it's the same. Right. So actually, you're making a good case for antitrust, right? Because Google and Apple and other companies might not have ever happened to the degree they did had Microsoft been able to squash that stuff. You know, when you kind of dominate something, you can squash good ideas that aren't yours that kind of compete with your way of doing things. It's probably inarguable that we have all kind of benefited from Microsoft being hobbled there, you know, ultimately that kind of worked in some way. But the same thing's happening right now with Google. We just don't know it. You know, they use that example of the vertical shopping site. That window is closed. Google gets vertical search now. They're all over it. You can go to Google Flights now and say, you can do incredible things. I was just, because we just spoke to Flight. The old way of searching for flights is no longer the way you search for flights. Mm. You can say, I happen to live in an area where I have multiple airports I can choose. I can put them all in. I can say my dates are flexible. I can say my times are flexible. I can say whatever. It's like this incredible search engine for flights that is unlike anything that's available on an Expedia type site or on an airline site or whatever. They've mastered it. It's over.
And you're proving your point.
Yeah.
Because all those other sites are now history because of the power of Google and search. Nobody goes anywhere else.
Right. And the only company that's even trying to compete with Google horizontally in search is Microsoft right now, right? And all they have is about 30% if you still use the combined Yahoo Microsoft share. So
they've been going
at this for years, right? Like years and years. I mean, like definitely over a decade, they've been trying to crack this.
You could really argue that the only reason they have any market share at all is because they make Windows. And
there's a reason. Those numbers are not human beings opening a web browser, going to Bing.com and typing in a search.
They're not choosing.
There is no way. This is back end stuff. This is not human beings choosing Bing. Just today, I mentioned to Brad that I had gotten some huge number of like photo views on Google Maps, and we were kind of talking.
Yeah, I had that big number too.
Yeah, 3 million, right?
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's like, what?
3 million.
So 3 million people have looked at photos.
I took a picture of a cafe down in Petaluma, and it says, congratulations, you just had 3 million views.
Yeah. So
no picture I've ever taken has ever had more than a few thousand.
I'm like, this is bigger than me on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook combined. Google Maps. So we're kind of going through it, and Brad said, does Bing have maps still? And I'm like, I don't know. Let's look.
Of course it does.
And the thing is,
but
they do, and it looks exactly like the Google thing. It's funny. Like, you can go to it. They have photos and everything, and it's basically the same thing, but I don't think anyone uses it. No. I really don't. Not, you know, literally, well, obviously, but
it doesn't work very well in New York, I can tell you, Bing Maps.
Oh, really?
Every time I try to use it, it takes me to the wrong place. Literally, like a totally wrong place, not where it should be on the map. I'm like, okay, like, how is this happening still? Come on.
There are people, I mean, look, there are people who hate Microsoft. There are people who hate Google. There are people who hate Apple, you know, but the notion that, like, I'm not going to use Google Maps because, you know, they're spying on me or whatever it is. Like, you're just punching yourself in the face. Like, you, how could you not use the best possible tool? And that makes this whole thing very sticky and not sticky in a good way. I mean, it makes it kind of a tough thing, because if you feel very strongly about this stuff, you have to basically compromise your life not to use Google, which I think is everything that you need to know about antitrust. I mean, they need to be looked at. I think they're in the same place Microsoft was. I really do. I just think there's no way to talk your way around the fact that these guys are not abusing their monopoly. Are abusing their monopoly.
No, I think this article convinced me. I had, what's funny is there's so much emotion and, you know, feeling about all of this. There's those who, the privacy people, there's people who are worried about technology. There's people who just don't like companies getting too big in general. There's a lot of moralizing going on. But ultimately, this policy can't be based on any of that. It has to be, we have to keep the playing field open to innovation, period. Right? And if it requires antitrust regulation to do that, then that's what we need to do.
I agree.
It is a messy process. The outcomes are never guaranteed, and it often doesn't work.
The only thing that's guaranteed is it's going to be slower than crap. Like, if you look at the EU, as successful as they've been, these things get dragged out and dragged out and dragged out. You know, one of three of their cases has kind of come to a head finally. This thing is going to be a 9-year process. And by the time it's all said and done, by the way, the stuff we're complaining about is gone. We've moved on.
I know.
Well, that's the technologist's argument, is it moves too slow. There's no point. Just let it go.
No, but
see what happens.
That's not. So, no. That's like, we're not going to study stem cells because we don't know if we'll ever see any success. No, you still do it. But maybe the issue is we speed up the process when it comes to something like antitrust.
Yeah.
It's not we don't do it because it's too slow.
Here's the question.
We fix the slowness.
We only really, I mean, I don't think you can, despite Duhigg's choice to use Standard Oil, which, by the way, happened 100.
The antitrust police are coming to Mary Jo's.
Happened 100 years ago. I mean, that was 100 years ago. So that's not a modern example. But Microsoft is the only modern example we have. So let me ask you guys, on balance, was that a good thing?
Yes.
I think it was in the end. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the evidence. That's the only data point I think it really is the only data point we have, at least when you talk about technology.
It absolutely was. And again, the reason you can say that with such clarity is just to look at the way that they were before antitrust. Look at the companies that they put out of business. Look
people
at the products.
People forget that. This is part of the problem is that
the kids
growing up now, most of the people listening don't even remember those days.
I know. We talked about that this morning.
Let's also be clear.
They don't even remember.
We owe a huge debt to Microsoft. Without making a stable platform in the 90s that's a different kind of debt. This show owes a huge – no. But without making a stable platform in the 90s, computing would not have got – Wintel was very important to the growth of computing, I think. Don't you?
Google is
hugely vital to the growth of the internet.
I think that stuff happens organically anyway. In the beginning of the personal computer industry, there were like tons of companies, lots of competition. It was bad for everybody because it was confusing. It was bad for developers, which platforms you support. I think things kind of naturally condense down on their own. Whether it was Microsoft or IBM or Apple or whatever, in some ways kind of doesn't matter. I think the same basic thing would have played out. It's just that there was one little variable thrown into the mixture, and it was Bill Gates, and he was not going to let it be Apple or IBM.
I think the cost argument too, right? Like, I think computers would have stayed very expensive if things hadn't kind of to a more standard platform.
But maybe that would have happened anyway.
That would have happened anyway. It would have happened anyway. There's no way that it didn't happen anyway. If Apple had won the computing wars and the Macs were super expensive, there would have been some little upstart that would have said, you know what, we can build the same stuff and sell it for one-fifth the price. I mean, it would have happened, you know.
Maybe.
It happens in every market.
It does need this platform that people can depend on.
It does.
You don't get, you know, Apple with the app ecosystem and Microsoft with the programming ecosystem. Without that, you don't get this amazing
My point is, it happened with Windows. It could have happened with something else.
Maybe.
It would have happened with Windows.
Yeah.
You know?
This is the book, by the way, I was referring to. We had Scott Galloway on Triangulation. It's worth listening to. The hidden DNA of Apple, Facebook, and Google, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Yeah. And the point
Notice
he makes,
that Microsoft is not part of this.
Yeah, not anymore. Well, his contention is it's almost impossible not to use these companies. I think you probably should throw Microsoft in, but they've been chastened, right? They've been spanked, and so maybe they're a little less threatening.
It's the four horsemen thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the four horsemen of the internet. And his position in this book, you know, it's a long book. There's a lot of detail and nuance. But it is essentially that these companies have a narrative that is completely fraudulent. That when you listen to them about how they're transforming the world, you know, Facebook's connecting us all, Amazon's eliminating friction in retail, and Google's making all the world's information available to you at your fingertips, that those stories are not really what's happening. That what's going to happen. Well, not necessarily not what they're aiming at. I think that those mission statements are accurate.
The way I would put it. Yeah. I was just talking to my wife about this the other day, you know, growing up in Dedham like I did and then moving back there as an adult. The one thing I always kind of wanted in my town was a big bookstore. Like, we used to travel out to towns a little bit far away to go to like a Barnes & Noble or Borders or whatever. And we'd wander around the store and I'd look at travel books and programming books and we'd get some magazines. We'd buy coffee and it was like a night. We would kind of hang out there, or we would go to a bookstore after we went out to dinner or whatever. By the time a bookstore did arrive in Dedham, I think it was a Borders eventually arrived right before they went out of business. I didn't want to go there anymore. And it was because of Amazon and because of I don't want to buy paper books anymore. I want to buy electronic books. And we went out of a sense of obligation just to kind of go and see it. And it was sad. You know, it was there are some books. Maybe I'll go on my phone and buy it from Amazon, or, you know, like it turns into this different thing. And you gain something from this transition, right? Obviously, things are more convenient, whatever. I don't have basically what amounts to fire kindling all over my house. But you also lose something. There's a little bit of a community around these things, right? People gather together. You talk to people. You see someone with a book and you have a little conversation about it, whatever it is. So you lose that. And it's not a net win, net loss per se. I would argue it's still better overall. But I agree that, you know, it's not the same, and you know, it's sad in some ways.
Yeah, there may be some good news on the horizon. It looks like Facebook's starting to erode a little bit. That certainly the confidence and affection people hold for Facebook starting to erode, including the number of people who are using it under 25. And so maybe there is evidence that technologies turn over naturally, maybe that will happen. I don't know. We're going to talk a lot more about this article, obviously, on the next show on This Week in Google.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm sure Jeff Jarvis will defend Google, but it'll be very interesting. Kevin Toefel will be joining us. He just got off a stint at Google.
He's not there now?
I don't think so, because we couldn't talk to him while he was there. So my thinking is, since he's on the show, he must be. It was a consulting gig. He's formerly of GigaOM, of course. Love Kevin. He's been on many times until he got his job at Google. And also Joan Donovan, who is really interesting. She works with I can't remember her name. but Dana Boyd and her data and society startup. She's the platform accountability research lead. So she talks very much about this and how particularly in Facebook and so forth. It's fascinating. So we're going to have a very good discussion on this whole topic. Nice. But I'm glad you guys brought it up because there is a big, you know, Microsoft's the test case.
It is.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting, you know, Apple has had a minor antitrust issue with the book stuff, Intel, like we said, in Europe, and now Google in Europe especially. And, you know, they have this evidence or experience to kind of look back at it and say, okay, what did they get right and what did they get wrong? They basically got everything wrong. So, you know, they should learn from that. I mean, they really did. They handled it as
Intel
poorly as they could
the entire time. How come Intel isn't as dominant as Microsoft?
How come Intel isn't?
Yeah, what happened? There's an example of a technology revolution that passed Intel by, right?
So Intel, I think actually the parallels of Microsoft are unbelievable. And it's hardware versus software, obviously. But Intel has actually done exactly what Microsoft did, which is get soft and complacent. And they've had to get their ass kicked a couple of times, like with X64, with portable chips, and then now today with these really highly mobile and efficient chips. The only thing that Intel has ever been able to do is build big, beefy power consumption chips. And when that was what the PC world needed, they were running high. And when that stopped being what the PC world needed, you know, for mainstream use, they don't even know where to turn. And I think the parallels between Intel and Microsoft are many. I mean, I see them as being very similar.
Yeah.
And yet, Intel's on the way out, right?
Yeah. Plus, Intel didn't fight.
Antitrust, they didn't fight. So the world has changed, right? So Microsoft's future, when we look at it, we say it's the cloud, and there's a great case to be made for that. And they have some pretty good software properties that can be transitioned to this cloud thing, and it looks good. So what's Intel's future, right? They're not gonna be the company building the mobile chipsets that power iPhones and whatever, even though I realize there's a modem and an iPhone. But they're obviously losing to Qualcomm and to the ARM guys. I think they still have a possible future in the cloud because of the data center stuff, but we're seeing the Snapdragon ARM stuff and low power in the cloud as well.
Is it too simplistic to cut away all the stuff and say simply that Intel was dominant with its platform for a period of several decades, and then along came an upstart with technological innovation, ARM, and they're getting beat? And that's the technologist's argument for why you don't need antitrust.
This is complicated because you have to go back to the beginning and think about how technologically inept Windows was back in the early days and compare it to how technologically inept the Intel chipsets were in the early days. They didn't have flat memory models. Mm-hmm. You know, this was how did Intel beat Motorola? How did x86 beat the 68000 chipset? Like how did PowerPC not and RISC not take over in the mid-90s? Yeah. Like it's not because Intel was technically excellent. Just like it isn't that Windows was technically excellent is the reason that it won in its own market, right? This was a company that was run by really aggressive businessmen who kind of forced their product down people's throats, basically. I mean, it worked. I mean, I don't mean to suggest this stuff was total crap.
No. But I think there's another piece too, Wintel, right? Like, I think you can't detangle those two companies, right? Like, Microsoft helped bring Intel into prominence. Intel helped bring Microsoft.
That wasn't a strategy. Like, Intel was supported by other software vendors in the early days, and Microsoft backed other platforms too. True. Microsoft in the early days put BASIC on anything that could, you know, boot up.
Yeah. But then, you know, the momentum, I would argue, was when they became a
parallel.
When the two became one, I think that's when things really took off, though. Like, would Intel have been as big and successful without Microsoft? No.
But I just think it's a coincidence of timing and place. Yes, absolutely.
I do not. I think it's collusion.
No collusion.
I would call it's definitely a partnership. But I mean, you could make a compelling case for various chipsets through the years.
It's like Tourette's. No collusion. Just say the word. No collusion.
Yeah, it's another one of those ones, though, Paul. Like, I think it's hard to go back and pull out, like, the timing, the people, the alliances.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Look, Intel tried to jam Itanium down our throat. Itanium was like their version of Longhorn.
They make technical mistakes. I mean, you could very well point to their technical failings as the reason why they're having trouble, frankly.
Yeah.
But you could say, you know, Microsoft missed the internet. And it was only with great dint of force that they were able to catch up.
Intel
and perhaps any competitive move.
X64.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's boy, I love this subject.
And by the way, for all the Intel, Microsoft, Wintel baloney, I've told the story many times. I asked about Dave Cutler at the first Windows NT 5.0 workshop or whatever, reviewers workshop. And he was working on 64-bit stuff. It wasn't Intel 64-bit stuff.
Right.
It was the compact stuff, the Alpha chipset. They knew that the Itanium was a dog, and they were looking elsewhere. And, you know, they were ready to drop Intel like a bad habit, just like they dropped IBM like a bad habit.
Yeah.
This was Dell and Microsoft, and a friend of mine who told me the story. But this is another great example of Microsoft and Intel, in this case, being two companies that deserved each other. And I think either one of them would have dropped the other one of them at any time if it had made sense to do so. I think they hate each other. I know they do today. I can tell you that this relationship is as strained as it could possibly be right now. If you think that Microsoft making Surface PCs hurt their relationship with the PC makers, Microsoft's relationship with Qualcomm, I think, has been a one-way disaster for that relationship with Intel.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
What a great subject. Well, there's a lot more to be said. Read the Sunday Times article, The Case Against Google. It's at least it starts the it's a great conversation starter.
It is.
Yeah. It's a big topic.
It is a big topic. And I think it's a topic. It's interesting. I mean, I really feel like there is a, you know, sometimes there's ideas whose time has come, you know, or people are just kind of as culturally just everybody's aware of it. And I think we're at that time now where people are really wondering, okay, these companies are really big, bigger, you know, you could argue.
The issue is.
And really powerful.
Antitrust was too slow for Microsoft. It took Microsoft 20 years to come to power.
Yeah.
It took Google 5.
Yeah.
It took Uber 2. It's taking these voice assistants 2. You know, it happens so fast now.
True.
That the, just the rate at which you have to suddenly start talking antitrust is not measured in decades anymore. It's measured in a couple of years.
Well, and then this is also another position, which is that no government regulation is any good, can make any sense. Yeah. Although even the anti-government people, I think, in a great majority, kind of recognize that antitrust is one of the few areas where you just have to weigh in, that the invisible hand is not perfect.
If you think about all the kind of memes or whatever you see in science fiction throughout the years, one of the big ones that repeats itself again and again is this notion that companies will be the countries of the future.
You know, I was thinking exactly that. Yeah. Right? That's a number one science fiction meme, right?
Yeah, it's got to be number one.
Corporations are the new government.
It's like the original Alien movie and the whole Alien series, just to put it in kind of
and
a
I
pop
culture.
And I feel
like we are moving that way. I really do feel like we're moving that way.
Well, I mean, at some point, like a company like Google, you could almost imagine them just kind of saying to the EU, like, yeah, we're not going to do that. And you can't stop us.
Yeah. What do you
Amazon.
Do
you can think of Amazon that way, too. Right. Yeah.
Yep.
And yet, I have to tell you, I'm not one of those people who fetishizes corporate power or government power.
no.
They're both flawed.
Yeah. Yep. But
you see somebody, I really feel like I'm looking at Mark Zuckerberg and I can almost read his mind as he looks at the chaos in Washington, D.C. and is saying to himself, I can do better than that.
Yeah.
Who couldn't do better?
Well, I feel like he's positioning himself and I feel like we could easily as a nation make a mistake. You know, we thought, well, here's a guy.
Here's an example.
We thought there are a lot of people in my life who think, well, a person who's a great businessman would make a great president. Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't think that anymore. I don't know. But I think
maybe the right businessman is possible. But the notion that a country could be run like a company.
That's a notion that a lot of people held. And I think maybe that's now maybe gotten a little shaken, but I can easily hear people saying, oh, but these technologists, they're the smartest people in our culture. Let's let them run the show.
Here's a little homework assignment for everyone watching or listening to the show, which is to watch the Mensa episode of The Simpsons to see how that works out. Because the truth is, that's not going to work.
Right. Right. Well, I'd rather have the smartest than the dumbest, but given the choice.
I agree. But, you know, the elite have the same special interests as anyone else. And whether you're an elite smart person or elite rich person or whatever, however you want to say it, if you're both, which these guys are, you know, we can talk about, you know, making everything equal and that's all fun and
but,
everything.
I mean, but would Elon Musk, would Mark Zuckerberg, would Tim Cook, would they make great national leaders? I don't know. I don't think so.
Does Elon Musk today make a great leader of a company? I mean, apparently not. That's the thing. Like, not by traditional measurements, right?
Yeah, so apparently not.
I don't know. Yeah, it's a tough one.
It is.
Well, that's why we're humans. So we can figure this out and talk it out and,
we got to do something to pass the time. We're going to live like 80-ish years. So
yeah, we got to do something. It's that or writing another Delphi 3 Super Bible.
And, yeah, exactly.
You know, I just wish more technologists would do what Bill Gates did. You know, like do your tech thing, then go save the world instead of trying to run the government.
I still have a little bit of a problem with this because, and again, this is extreme. I don't mean to compare Bill Gates to Hitler per se, but to give you kind of an extreme parallel to that. You know, if the Germans had won World War II and Hitler and the Nazis had solved cancer, would that have made that all okay? That's extreme and it's crazy. But this guy ran roughshod over the industry, became a billionaire, became the world's richest person. And now he's doing a couple of nice things in his waning years. You know, he's solving problems and stuff. And that's great. And how could you ever dump on that? Well, I don't know. Let's go back and talk to Osborne.
Carnegie. Andrew Carnegie is the example that comes up. The steel baron who was rapacious when he was running U.S. Steel and felt so bad about it that when he retired, he built libraries in every town in the country.
I'd rather have Bill Gates run something like his foundation than see Bill Gates run.
The difference is that as much money as the Bill Gates Foundation or the Zuckerberg Initiative have, it is a pittance compared to the amount of money government spends in charity and other good works, foreign aid and all of that. So if you really want to change the world, run for president.
I don't want to change the world. I just want word processing to be free. Can we just solve that?
Notepad for everyone.
Did Howard Hughes have a political ambition? I can't remember. Did he ever run Howard Hughes?
Man.
I don't know.
Oh, boy.
Wistful says, I'm tired of everything being so political. Let's change the subject. All right, let's take a break and come back and we'll talk more. We've got Windows. We've got Mixed Reality. We've got Alex Kipman. We've got Xbox. It's all coming up. Paul Thurrott, Mary Jo Foley, and Windows Weekly. Our show today brought to you by the folks at Quicken Loans. Great founder at Quicken Loans who founded Quicken Loans in, I want to say, the 90s, the mid-90s, as Rock Capital. Was bought by Quicken. They renamed it Quicken Loans. And then Dan Gilbert decided, 3 years in, I'm going to buy it back. I want to run it myself. I know what to do. He is Quicken Loans, of course, headquartered in Detroit. He's done so much to revitalize downtown Detroit. He's a technologist. I like that. It's Quicken Loans has grown to the number two lender in the country right after the big bank, $92 billion in loans. But they've never lost sight of making it easy, making it better for customers. They realized that the loan approval process needed a client-focused technological revolution, and that's why Quicken Loans kind of went back to their old name and created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage is an entirely online mortgage approval process. It is so easy. You don't have to go to a bank. You don't have to beg. You don't have to fill out a loan application of 25 pages. And you know, to add insult to injury, after you fill out this massive application with the other guys, and we did this 4 years ago with that big bank, you know, the one that still has horses and stagecoaches. We filled out this long form. And then they come back and say, okay, now we need this, 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 and this. You go get all that paperwork, you know, pay stubs and bank statements, blah, blah, blah. And then they call. For months, they came back and they'd say, oh, now, okay, well, what about 1998? What did you do then? It's like, I don't know. It was endless. Literally took us more than a month to get our home loan. We almost lost the house. If Rocket Mortgage would be here, it would take not a month, not a week, not even days, but minutes. You got to do this. RocketMortgage.com/windows. You can. It's not a long application form. You could, something you could do on your phone. Just answer a few basic questions you already know the answer to. Because Rocket Mortgage has trusted partnerships with all the financial institutions, all you have to do is say, yes, I give you permission. Or you, actually, I think it goes through. You go through your institution and say, yeah, give Rocket Mortgage this information. They crunch the numbers. Then based on income, assets, and credits, they say, here's what you're good for. Pick your terms, you know, your down payment, your term of the loan, your rate. You pick it. They say, good, you're approved. In minutes, like a few minutes. Like, you could do this at an open house with your smartphone. That's how easy Rocket Mortgage is. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply. Understand fully. There's no mystery. They explain every step of the way. Mortgage confidently. Great for refis, too. Go to Rocket Mortgage. You could start right now. Set it up. Begin the process. You don't have to apply for a loan to just begin the process. RocketMortgage.com/windows. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, at MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/windows. And now's a great time to refinance, by the way. The rates are going to go up. Guaranteed. It's practically guaranteed, as much as anything can be. RocketMortgage.com/windows. We thank them for their support of Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott, author of The Vista Secrets, Delphi Super Bible.
You have the thin first edition. There was a double size version of that came out later.
Oh my goodness. And Mary Jo Foley, allaboutmicrosoft.com. What else can we talk about? What else is hot in the news? How about let's talk about mixed reality? Who is Alex Kipman? Why do I know that?
Yes,
name?
Please explain this to everybody.
Okay. Alex Kipman is a technical fellow at Microsoft. He also is the guy who created the Kinect. What else did he create?
Windows Vista Ultimate.
Is that really his thing? Was that his?
Yeah. What was it called? Ultimate something?
Ultimate Extras?
Ultimate Extras.
Was it?
Yep.
Yeah, he's been around Microsoft for a while. He's seen now as a visionary. He's part of the Windows and Devices group, works for Terry Myerson. And he's the guy who has been championing the HoloLens, right? I don't know if it's fair to say he created the concept for the HoloLens, but he was instrumental in Microsoft's development of the HoloLens.
Yeah.
So this week he came back. I guess every year he takes off the month of January. Must be nice, Alex. He goes back to Brazil, which is where he's from, and kind of has a sabbatical, thinks about things, and comes back and writes a post about
on LinkedIn about what he thinks
will be big in mixed reality in 2018. So you should listen to this guy, right? Because he's the guy who Microsoft's looking to for what's next in mixed reality, virtual reality, augmented reality. So he lists in his post three trends that he thinks are going to be big in 2018. The first is MR plus AI. So mixed reality plus AI. This one is kind of vague to me what that actually means. But all buzzwords converge at Microsoft. So yeah. The idea, they've already said next version of HoloLens, which will be either sometime this year or next year, will have a holographic processing unit in it that will be able to incorporate AI and process AI workloads at the edge, you know, the intelligent cloud, edge thing.
There was a memo that went out at Microsoft to all of the business leaders that said you need to figure out how to use the term AI in everything you you describe your product.
Exactly. I agree. Yeah. It's like, make sure you say AI somehow, somewhere.
Yep.
He says, this is the year mixed reality in the cloud becomes real. I don't really know what that means because I don't know what it means because I feel like it's already a cloud thing, right? Mixed reality is a cloud thing. AI is a cloud thing. So I'm not sure. He's trying to give us a hint there. I'm not sure what the hint is. The next one on his list, trend number two, AR plus VR, right? So this is the Microsoft promise that augmented reality and mixed reality will be able to work together. Remember that video they first put out when they came out with the HoloLens where Some people were wearing a HoloLens and some were wearing mixed reality headsets and they were all talking to each other. This is supposed to happen this year.
Yeah, I guess. Windows Mixed Reality, the platform, it's very clear that version one, which is just virtual reality, is only partway towards some vision they have for merging AR and VR. And that's why they use the term mixed reality. Today what they're saying is mixed reality can be any mixing of real reality and some augmented virtual whatever reality. Right. But I think the ultimate end game is this AR plus VR thing. That's how I think they really mean MR. And it makes sense that this would be something that they would be looking at for year two.
Yeah. Trend three to me is the most interesting one. This is immersive communications. This is holoportation. Remember that whole idea? Like you can not pretend, but you can like beam yourself like Star Trek style to
this
a
is
place
how I plan to spend
there.
The last 20 years of my life.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And
the convenience
so for me,
of not leaving home.
Exactly. You and me, we could be in this thing. We could go to a meetup together, but not even neither of us would be at the meetup.
It'd be the perfect meetup. We don't have to go.
It would be. but the reason this is interesting to me is for a while, Microsoft was doing a lot of research in holoportation. They had like a lot of Microsoft researchers working on this and they had shown a bunch of demos that it was possible. Then all these guys led by Jeff Hahn, who Microsoft brought in when they bought his Perceptive Pixels startup, they all left together and they created this new company called Perceptive.io. So they took all this stuff Microsoft had been working on and went. Now, Perceptive.io's website has disappeared recently, which either means they went out of business or somebody bought them and they're keeping a low profile. I haven't been able to find out about that. But in the interim, Microsoft bought last year this company called Altspace VR, which is like the social communications company that does stuff through virtual reality and mixed reality. And they've done nothing public with that so far. But Kipman says, our work with Altspace VR is just the beginning, and you will see us bring this innovation forward in new ways this year. So maybe we're going to see what they're doing with Altspace VR. Maybe there's some other things in play around holoportation, but he's hinting some pretty big things for this year. And so far, we haven't really gotten a lot of tangible tips, hints about what these are. Maybe we'll hear more at Build, since Build is supposed to cover AR, VR. As one of the big topics. I don't know.
When Microsoft first revealed the HoloLens, which I think it was that January event where they talked about Windows 10. I think that was the same time.
It was.
They started talking. They were talking down something that was either they had said holograms or they clearly were indicating they were about to talk about holograms. And I thought to myself, they are going to basically project a hologram onto the stage, and it is going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that that's what it was going to be. And then you realize you're putting on a helmet, and then you find out later this is like little viewport thing, and it's significantly less exciting than what I sort of imagined in my head. But I do sort of think that is a future for this kind of stuff, right? And it's not the way I imagined it, but this holoportation, was that the word?
Holoportation,
because there's a receiving and a sending end, and actually they're each is both, really, when you think about it. But, you and I could be projected into a room, at a meetup, like to use your example, and where we are, whether we're wearing a headset or not, it almost doesn't matter, but however that technology works, external cameras and sensors or whatever, could appear to be standing in that room with those people as well. And it's kind of a two-way kind of a thing. And I don't know that Microsoft's the one who makes that happen. I think it's cool they're working on it. But I do think there's a really interesting future for that kind of thing.
Yeah. And, them owning Skype kind of makes you think, okay, they should be able to be kind of at the forefront of where real-time communications is going.
Yep.
Or maybe not, if you are not a fan of Skype.
So this is the future of communications as envisioned by Luke Skywalker doing astral projection in the latest Star Wars movie. Is that?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I, for one, look forward to our mixed reality future.
Yes.
I have mixed feelings.
I don't think we talked about this last week, too. They're now renting out HoloLens. Did we even mention that on the show last
renting
week?
Renting it? Who are they renting it to?
I know. So if you're a company or an individual and you want to rent a HoloLens for some period of time, Microsoft has a deal with a company called Abcom Rents now, where you can go and rent a HoloLens.
They're getting
for like what a day?
I think a day or longer.
A company would do it, I guess, if they wanted. I don't know.
Yeah, like at a trade show.
What can you do in one day? Oh, a trade show.
You go to the local Blockbuster Video and pick up your HoloLens.
Exactly.
I mean, isn't the HoloLens still really a dev kit? I mean, it's really for people who want to write software for it.
It is.
You can't do that in a day.
It's all. How long has this thing been out? I mean, it feels like.
Wasn't that like 2015 when we first heard about the HoloLens?
Yeah, it was 2015 when we first heard about it. So maybe 2 years it's been shipping.
Yeah.
Coming up in 2 years. It feels like it's been longer than that, but I guess it's only been two.
It was May 2016 when the dev kit started to ship.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah. I know. It does feel like it's been around a lot longer, but we're already talking about V2 now. So, yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So that's Alex Kipman and Mixed Reality in a nutshell.
In a nutshell. In a nutshell.
Just in a nut, really.
Windows 10 Fall Creators Update, 85% usage share. 85% of what?
All this stuff in 30 minutes. 85% of all Windows 10 PCs.
Okay.
Are running the latest version.
That's a lot.
That's actually fairly incredible. I mean,
really high.
Yeah, given corporate PCs and whatnot, you might think maybe 80% is kind of the max you're ever going to see. So that's kind of interesting. So, for the fourth time today, Siri has piped up without. No, don't find anything, honey. Just leave me alone. It's just terrible.
She loves you.
I have the worst conversations with her. Anyway, it hit 75% last month. I mean, I guess you could say it's slowing down, but there's not much left to go. I mean, I think this is pretty much it. I mean, how do you achieve higher than this? So next month, they will probably finish the next version. The month after that, they'll start shipping that. We'll be moving on to that, but whatever that's going to be called. But this thing has been very successful from a rollout perspective. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, that's them's iOS numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, and in a similar frame of time. That's true.
Windows 10 on ARM. Whoa. We saw him at CES.
Yeah,
we'll see him at Mobile World Congress, probably.
So that's what I'm wondering. We know about three PCs. Mobile World Congress is what, next week, probably, coming up on it? Maybe there'll be more, but it's interesting to me there's only three so far. But what we learned today is that there are going to be 14 carriers around the world that will carry or support these devices. Most interesting for people here in the United States, all four major U.S. carriers are involved. So AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile will all support Windows 10 on ARM.
And they gave a list of the retail outlets that are going to carry them. We figured Microsoft stores, of course. Also Amazon, what else? JD.com, Italy. Like, we have all these different countries with all these different retail outlets. In the UK, Asus stores, BT Shop, John Lewis, PC World. So these are going to be out there in retail in a very big way in many countries, which is kind of interesting.
Do we think this is going to be a big deal right away? Like, we've had cellular connectivity in PCs here and there.
Yeah.
What's the deal here? Do you think this is going to be big?
You know, I'm kind of two minds about it. At first, I was thinking it was going to be more of a business play, you know, like that they would try to sell this as a first-line worker thing and maybe also to the education space and make it a Chromebook competitor type thing. But now I'm thinking, no, I think this could be another way for them to get back into mobile. Microsoft, that is, when I'm saying they and their OEMs. If you're looking at who is the target audience for this, me, right? People who don't run a lot of Win32 apps, who need the battery
life. What about the connectivity thing? Are you interested in paying for connectivity for that device in addition?
That's the real problem. Especially since we already pay for it on our phone and we can hotspot
If you could add it to your contract and it would be like a cheap add-on?
Like the Apple Watch is $10 extra a month.
Yeah. Right. What right. if it's something like a
complete ripoff?
but I
pay it.
You could use that on your PC. I think it almost requires something like that. And I think the real play here is going to be that there's this generation of people have come up in the world on these smaller devices and cellular connectivity. Mm-hmm. You know, here in the United States, we're used to having a lot of Wi-Fi everywhere or whatever. But out in the world, I guess, you know, you want to have connectivity no matter where you are. The trick is going to be selling this thing. I mean, it's a PC, obviously, and it's going to cost extra to have data, obviously. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think this kind of thing has ever been super popular. Even like iPads that have cellular connectivity are probably kind of a limited success story. I'm sure they do pretty well, but they might do the, you know, iPads might be the best example of a non-phone cellular, you know, dedicated cellular plan kind of thing.
You know, the part that interests me and maybe other people isn't so much the cellular part, although there are people who care about that. It's more the battery life.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, that's the draw here. It's like if it really has the kind of battery life that they've been talking about, that would be more interesting to me than the cellular part.
I will say from the perspective of the PC as a platform, this is actually pretty big. I do think this is a fundamental thing. It's much needed, and it is the two things we just described. It's just seamless connectivity regardless of how you connect. You don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. And then the what I would call uptime, which is kind of a combination of actual battery life and then standby time, which is supposed to be stellar on these devices.
I wish I could find stats on the sales of iPads with LTE versus
that would be interesting.
Without LTE. My guess is it's a small fraction of the total iPad
But
sales.
On the flip side, it's also probably the best-selling device of its kind, meaning a non-phone where you're paying for cellular dedicated device. It probably is the best one.
It's one of those things where if you said to me, oh, you could have a very light laptop with all-day battery life and always-on connection, I'd say, yeah, that's great.
Yep. And yeah, it's going to be $60 extra a month.
Then I'm less interested.
It's like having a high HOA on an apartment.
Yeah, I know.
Like, you know, it seems like a good idea until you get to the actual details.
It does. Yeah. I mean, if you live somewhere where Wi-Fi isn't available.
That's the problem, right? Anywhere you go in New York, you can get Wi-Fi, right?
You can.
Rattle and Hum has Wi-Fi, right?
That doesn't always work, so it'd be nice to have a backup.
Well, what if it was a pay-as-you-go kind of thing?
Yeah.
And I don't know who offers these. We have to listen
Karma
to the
Go I mean, used to. Remember Karma Go? Mm-hmm. And they went to the subscription model. I think pay-as-you-go may not be a very good model.
Like a viable model. Yeah, yeah.
People buy the card. And
but as a user, what you kind of need is the thing that's going to fill in the gaps, you know. Even on, like, Project Fi, like, when I travel, occasionally I'll be in a place where I don't get Wi-Fi for whatever reason, and I'll tether the phone, and then I'll use more data that month, of course.
Yeah.
But it's worth it because I can at least get online. And it in a sense, that is a pay-as-you-go kind of deal, right? I mean, I'm paying extra as I go. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They need to make this seamless. You know, seamless connectivity is one thing. Seamless access to the connectivity, like seamless billing or whatever. I think it needs to be part of it.
That's supposed to be like integrated into the store with the eSIM payment stuff, right? Like that's supposed to be something you can just buy.
Google Fi, you can get a data only SIM, and it just plugs in. It doesn't cost more. It's just part of your data plan, you know, and you pay as you go on Google Fi. So. That's what I put in my iPad. I put a Google Fi SIM in my iPad.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
You pay as you go.
Yeah.
Basically.
That's good.
Because I already have a Google Fi account. And you can order unlimited data SIMs from Google Fi. Mm-hmm. They don't even charge you for them, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, yeah. It seems like a great idea. And then, you know, I have a LTE slot in this Lenovo, but I've never put anything in it.
I don't think anyone has. Do we even know if those things work?
I don't know. I haven't. Right. It's here.
I mean, we should know pretty soon. Like they've said Q1, haven't they, for the availability?
Is it Q1? It's sometime early this year. I'm not sure the exact date, but definitely the first half of the year, sure.
Yeah.
I'm popping out the
I should really see if I can put a SIM in it. I have used a data SIM in a Windows PC, and I did it so I could write about it for the book. And it is, you know, it's entertaining on a number of levels. Hopefully this is going to be a more seamless experience than it has been in the past.
I should put a SIM in here, see what happens.
Yeah, you should.
I literally never put I can't remember if I think that Lenovo's weird that way. Like, they'll put this slot here, but there may be nothing on the other side. You know, it might just be a hole.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
I can't. There's even a metal connectors in there. I should put a SIM in and see what happens.
Yeah.
See what happens. Just try it. Just try it, Leo. What could possibly go wrong?
Just make sure you already have the latest feature update downloaded before you do that.
Oh, yes. I'm now on a metered connection. Let's see. Oh, but it's Windows 10S. Is Windows on ARM 10S? I thought 10S was gone.
Yeah, I'm curious about this.
It is, right?
Well, we've seen Windows 10S on the devices. I don't think it's a given that it will always be Windows 10S.
Oh, really? Huh. Yeah. I thought it was 10S, which is really Windows 10 Pro in S mode.
And you can upgrade it to Pro.
You can upgrade it to Pro for free for some period of time from each of the OEMs. So, yeah, that's why some of these limitations that you found out about over the weekend, I was like, it makes sense, like Hyper-V isn't there.
I got some weird email and feedback about this stuff. But I think we're losing track of something here, which is that Windows 10 on ARM targets the mainstream, like Mary Jo was saying. You know, this is for people like her and normal people. Yeah. It absolutely is. It's right. It will run most of what you want to run. It will run actually pretty much everything you'd want to run, really. It will have better battery life and uptime and so forth. It's not going to do some crazier things, like it's not going to support Hyper-V. Well, great. No, it's a machine with 4 gigabytes of RAM. Of course, it's not going to support Hyper-V. It's an ARM chipset. You know, it's amazing enough to me that you can emulate x86 code on an ARM chipset today. You want to run a virtualization environment that is like a to-the-metal technology designed for x86. You want to run that thing on ARM, and then you want to use that to virtualize x86 VMs? Come on. What are you talking about? I mean, it's crazy. But people have complained about this to me. Like, people are upset about, I was going to get one of these things. Oh, I can't. I need Hyper-V. And it's like, guys, seriously.
It's not for you guys.
It's for mainstream stuff. Now, there is some stuff going on that will change over time, right? So, for example, it's not going to support 64-bit apps of any kind right away. But it will over time. And I believe that includes both x64 and ARM64 native apps. Yeah. Right now, it's a 64-bit OS, 32-bit apps. There's some assistive technology stuff. And I got a couple of complaints about that as well. I think that stuff will happen. This is a V1 product. You got to give it some time. If you need assistive technologies, this conversation is the same as if you are a gamer or power user of any kind, whatever, developer, you have many options for a computer that will run those things that you need. So let's not complain because this cute little newcomer doesn't do the exact thing that you want. It's okay. You know, honestly, I am impressed that this list isn't longer and more inclusive. So they had made the contention that Windows 10 on ARM is Windows 10, and it's a little bit of a fantasy. Obviously, it's a subset as it would be, but honestly, it's pretty much Windows 10.
Mm-hmm.
Can I put Chrome on it?
Come out will be 10S.
So I can't put Chrome on it.
No, but you could upgrade it for free to Windows 10 Pro.
Then I can put Chrome on it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. So it is Windows 10.
Yeah, it will be.
Ish.
Once you fix it. Yeah, it's Windows 10-ish. That's exactly right.
recovery tools. You want to talk about those?
Yeah, I'm going to do this quickly because this is a hairy topic. This is the Windows 10 fail guide thing I was talking about. I have been working on updating the book for the latest version of Windows 10. I have a bunch of chapters that are in development. I wanted to kind of get a win over the weekend. I'm like, I'm going to do one chapter. I'm going to finish it. I'm going to put it out to readers. Let me pick one where nothing has changed. I picked the backup and recovery chapter, started going through it. God damn this company. Everything changed, and I am freaking out. And I'll just give you like a high-level version of this. People will remember this stuff. When Windows 8 debuted, they had PC reset and PC refresh. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Really quick way to blow away the computer and come back with a fresh copy of Windows.
Yeah.
PC reset was nuked from orbit. It destroyed everything. It was just like you got it on day one.
Yeah.
PC refresh allowed you to save your some settings, your personal data, your account, obviously, and then any apps you install from the store. But it would blow away all of your desktop applications, and it would reinstall Windows and then put everything else back. It was a good idea. When Windows 10 debuted, they actually combined them into one tool. They just called it Reset This PC, and there's a wizard. You can choose which route you want to take. You can do both things. So, nice. In Windows 10 1607, the anniversary update, they added something called Refresh Windows. This is awesome. This was so awesome. I used it as a tip. I had it as a tip on this podcast. I wrote it up on the website. The notion behind this is that what it would do is download the latest version of Windows, not the one that was on your computer, but the latest version, and then it would clean install Windows, and you would get a clean version of Windows. And the reason that's such a great idea is if you bought your PC from Lenovo or HP or Dell or any PC maker that put a bunch of crap on there, you could use Refresh Windows not to go back to the thing they gave you, but to go back to Windows as originally envisioned by Microsoft, a clean version of Windows. Awesome idea. So there's other backup recovery stuff in Windows, legacy tools like Windows Backup and so forth, but just focusing on this one part of it. In the latest, in Windows 10 version 1709, the Fall Creators update, the link for Refresh Windows is still there, but it doesn't go to Refresh Windows anymore. It goes to a new tool called the Windows Defender Security Center, which has inside of it a link to a tool called Fresh Start, which is not Refresh Windows. What it is it's actually the subset of Reset This PC that used to be called PC Refresh. What it does is it blows away Windows. It kills your Windows desktop apps. You have to reinstall those. But it keeps your account. It keeps some of your settings. It keeps your personal data. And it keeps any store apps you have installed. So basically, in the latest version of Windows 10, they've gone back to the way it was in Windows 8, except that these two tools are not next to each other in the recovery part of settings. One of them is there. And the other one is in a tool called Windows Defender Security Center that no one has ever heard of and will never find. And this is what I deal with. And if you think that my life has changed at all since when I wrote the Delphi 3 Super Bible, I'm telling you that this is exactly the same stuff. I am documenting the undocumentable. This is my life. It's unbelievable.
You know what? The thing I liked the most about that post when I read it was there are too many ways of doing the same thing in Windows all across the board. Like a lot of times I'll figure out how to do something and then I'll do it accidentally another way. And then I'll be like, wait, that's not how I did it the last time. Right. And I know choice is good and all, but it feels like you want some dependable paths to do certain things where you can kind of count on it. Like it's going to work like this. And then you suddenly do it a different way and you're like, oh, wait, what?
I did invent this concept, you know, the notion that if you go into a supermarket and there are 150 bottles of ranch dressing that you suddenly freeze and can't make a choice. But yeah. I call this the tyranny of choice. And it's a problem. Yeah. It's a problem that Microsoft has always had. And it's a problem we have seen in Windows many, many times throughout the years. In Windows 10 today, tied to this, there are approximately 9 different ways you can recover your PC back to the way it was in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, but this is ridiculous. And that's another topic. But I'll just point out the Refresh Windows thing that I like so much is still available on the web. You can go find it for yourself. So if you bought a PC from any PC maker and it comes with Windows 10, and what you want to do is get a clean version of Windows on there and you don't want any of the PC maker stuff, you can still use that tool to blow away your install Windows and make a clean.
Don't give me another choice.
It's another choice. I know.
No.
It's insane. Welcome to my world. I'm sorry.
Surface firmware updates are coming out for Spectre and Meltdown. That's interesting.
Yeah, and just tied to this, I'll just say that Intel, as we were doing the show, I think, re-released their fixes for their last three generations of microprocessors. That stuff's happening. Microsoft's advice is that you need to keep Windows up to date through Windows Update, and then you need to go to your PC maker for whatever tools they have to make sure that you're getting the latest firmware updates, because that's how you get the stuff from Intel.
Yeah.
Well, in the case of Surface, that's nice because you only have one place to go. It's all in Windows Update. Today or sometime this week, they shipped a firmware update for Surface Pro 3 that specifically addresses this thing. It comes with the fix for Spectre and Meltdown that came from Intel originally, and they're passing it through to the Surface devices. So Surface Pro 3, I don't know if it's the first one, but it's the first one where I noticed they actually called it out. Like, this is what we're doing with this thing. Mm. So if you have one of those devices, make sure you get it.
Get it and enjoy it. The Redstone 5 build is out now.
Yeah. So right after our show last week, Microsoft released a new build of Redstone 4 to FastRank. And then they also introduced the first build of Redstone 5. A lot of people had been thinking they were going to do that fairly soon, and they did. If you're on Skip Ahead, you could get that Redstone 5 build. But if you're not on Skip Ahead, you cannot. And as usual, there's nothing really huge in terms of new features in it yet. It's still very early. It's build 17604. But it includes a lot of the same things that are in that most recent Redstone 4 build. So they're kind of building these two things in parallel, even though the branches have split. Not much else to say about it, really. I mean,
okay,
it's out there. It's out there. Here comes Redstone.
RS4 is so yesterday.
It is.
I hope they change the recovery tools again in RS5, because let me tell you.
Yeah, keep you going.
I don't even understand. I don't understand the point of what they're doing anymore.
No.
No.
They're giving you something to write about for another book. That's it.
I wanted to. Oh, by the way, still have not delivered this. I have to completely rewrite this chapter now. They changed so much. It's really frustrating.
Paul.
I worked on this all day Sunday.
Are you still putting stuff on dead trees? Why, Paul?
No. It's an ebook.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's killing pixels.
That's easy. Is it possible, somebody's saying in the chat room, Londog's saying in the chat room, that Microsoft is going to be limited in the amount of people they can skip ahead to 5 because they have all the beta testers they need?
Yeah, I think they said literally. Mm-hmm. Well, what they said was it was already full. Like, they were taking the group they already had. But I saw on Twitter that someone kind of said, hey, if you want to get in here, join now, because I guess they left it open secretly. I suspect if you were to try to join Skip Ahead today, you might discover that you're stuck on RS4, like the Luddite that you are.
Yeah, it won't be for long, though, I bet you.
No.
By golly. Any day now.
Raphael tells me he has a registry hack that will get people into RS5.
Of course. But it also
follow within Raphael on Twitter, and he can find that there, I bet.
He's good at that. Let's do some Xbox, and then we'll get to the back of the book. Paul Thurrott with our latest Xbox news.
Yeah, I know Mary Jo's not that excited to this, so I'll try to keep it to 20 or 25 minutes only.
Thanks.
No, it's quick. Last fall, Microsoft said that they were going to add 1440p support to the Xbox One X. What that means is that if you have the latest 4K console, I think it's called super sampling, right? When you go down like that, you have a 4K image and you super sample it down to either 1080p or a lower resolution. So it still looks awesome. Like, it looks better than it would if it was just straight 1080p content or whatever. I happen to use a 1440p display with my Xbox One X, so I have been waiting for this. But someone asked someone from Microsoft about this recently, and they replied that, yeah, we're still doing this. But he mentioned that it's also coming to the Xbox One S, and that means they're also going to be upsizing content. I think that's the right term, that plays on the Xbox One S. And so if you're on that version of the console, that version does not play 4K content, although you could download 4K content, but it plays 1080p and down, you know, obviously there are lower resolutions as well. So I guess it's upsized, but it will natively support 1440p as well. So you get kind of just a better effect than if it had to emulate the 1080p display. So that is coming soon. And the good news, it's going to be on Xbox One X and S. And I apologize if I got those terms correct. I always screw those up. The other thing that Microsoft's been talking about for a while coming to the Xbox One is keyboard and mouse support. Of course, people who are PC gamers are kind of envisioning this future where they can, you know, blow away all the people on the controllers by playing on a more accurate mouse and keyboard kind of thing. It's not really being added for that purpose, right? The way Microsoft describes it is that there are people with assistive needs who might need to play with those kinds of controls instead of a normal controller, and so they want to enable that support. And they're probably going to just enable it on kind of a app-by-app basis so the app maker can determine whether or not to support that kind of stuff. Obviously, a keyboard would be nice just for typing things in. I don't think we're ever going to see an instance where – you boot up into Call of Duty and some people are on keyboard and mice and some people are on controllers. Console games are designed to be played on a controller by default, you know, by nature. They're just, their systems are less accurate because they don't have that sense of accuracy. Auto aim probably, well, auto aim probably predates or was on PC too, but auto aim is basically a requirement on a console because the controller is so much less precise than a keyboard and a mouse. Anyway, it is still coming. Informally, you can actually do it now, apparently, with some kinds of dongle or adapters, and Microsoft's allowing it again for people with assistive needs. But if you wanted to play like a high speed 3D, you know, first person shooter using a mouse and a keyboard, I don't think that's actually ever going to happen. You know, slow moving RTS or something, maybe. Applications, absolutely. You know, if you want to use Netflix or something like that, there's no reason to block the support there. But it's not going to be like PC gaming, basically.
I know Mary Jo's just dying to get mouse and keyboard support on her Xbox One S.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She literally nodded off when I said 1440p.
I did. I was like,
That's why I take you off camera, Mary Jo, just to protect just you.
The dull
I remember
stare,
you put me as an Xbox stare. User once in my lower third.
Yeah, that was mean of me.
Xbox fan Mary Jo.
It Bowen. Wasn't me. It was Brad.
It was that guy.
It was Brad. He put
Fireman you
on. Fireman Brad. Tips of the week, starting with more games. I'm sorry. EA games on sale. Paul Thurrott.
Yeah, so if you're an Xbox gamer, and this is Xbox 360 and Xbox One, be sure to head over to Major Nelson's blog because he's got a list of all the games that are on sale right now. A big part of it is an annual publisher's sale that EA has, and their games are all up to 75% off. And these are like serious games, like Battlefield 1.
Ooh.
One is 75% off. Like, wow. This is a great time to buy. So, obviously, EA is big on all the sports games, Madden and so forth. Just be sure you look through the list because there are some incredible savings. And then beyond EA, actually, there are games that are up to 85% off, non-EA as well.
I'm saving my hard drive in my quarters for Sea of Thieves. I'm very excited about that.
Mm.
I don't want to get any new games because I might. You
know, yeah, but look at this list. It's,
I know. It's really good.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And if you look on the right, under notes, it says pub sale. Those are the, in the chart there,
yeah.
Those are the EA games.
Okay.
And
I sorted by notes. That was a mistake.
Yeah, I was going to say, what happened there?
I sorted by notes. But look at, if you sort by discount, wow. There's 85% off Battle Islands.
Yep.
Gems of War. Hawken. NBA Live. The
Battlefield 1 Premium Pass, 75% off.
That's a great deal. That's nice.
Yep.
I want to play Battlefield 1. That's great.
Yeah.
Battlefield Bundle, 75% off.
Mirror's Edge Catalyst, 75% off.
Look at that.
Titanfall 2. Ultimate Edition, 75% Titanfall off. 2. You know, there's some good stuff in there.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Your app of the week?
So Microsoft, I don't remember. Maybe it was CES or sometime recently. They showed off, I think it was just in a video. It was at BET. They had an educational video where they were showing off like a companion app for the Photos app in Windows 10 that would run on a phone. And the idea is that you have pictures that you take on the phone and then you can wirelessly transmit them to the PC. Now, I've moved to the way that I use photos from my phone on my PC is I just put them in Google Photos. And so they go there automatically.
Yeah.
Within a minute after I take them, I go to the web and there they are and I can download them to the PC. And that's how I do that. But this is aimed primarily at education. But actually, this is probably useful for anybody because there are going to be instances where you can imagine an educational institution where the kids are sharing a phone, sharing a PC. They don't have an account they can put it to that they all have access to. This is a way while you're standing there in a room to just wirelessly transmit the stuff from the phone to the PC. It's actually a pretty cool utility. And I could see, by the way, the iPad picture is awesome because it's just the iPhone version in the bigger screen.
With a lot of border space.
It's an iPhone app. But you know, because a lot of people, why do I need this? I just use the cloud. It's because not everyone can use the cloud, you know, or maybe you're in a place where you can't use the cloud at that point.
Right.
So
what does this
actually
use? Does this use Wi-Fi? Does it use Bluetooth?
Yeah, it's Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi.
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just good to know about.
And then, I wish you hadn't told me about this next one here.
Yeah. I got more coming after this too, because So Age of Empires is a classic RTS.
Love it. From the 90s,
basically, I think.
Yeah.
So they've completely remastered it. 4K graphics. They've added in the Rise of Rome expansion pack. It's available now on Windows 10. They're actually going to go back and redo this, do this exact thing for Age of Empires 2 and Age of Empires 3 as well. So those are actually going to come out later this year. But the first one is out now. And it's, you know, it's one of those classic God games, basically. Like,
it started it all, though, for me. I mean, this is really the – it's real-time strategy. It's not turn-based like Civilization. It's a lot of fun. You play online or you can play campaigns. And I always loved this game. I might have to – so is it in the Microsoft Store?
Yeah, it's a Windows 10 app. A Windows 10
store.
Game.
It's PWA. Yeah. I mean, WPA. Well, I mean, MZZ. It's one of them.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
Yeah, baby. You know what I'm talking about. Enterprise pick of the week.
It's kind of more of a developer pick of the week, but still may be of interest to some enterprise users. And maybe you, Leo, since you were talking about Lisp earlier.
Yes. Yes, I was.
I seem to have a lisping problem.
I'm very interested.
So VS Code, which is Microsoft's cross-platform lightweight editor, now is part of the Anaconda Python distribution. Let me translate that for people. Python is now becoming an AI language, largely an AI language. Anaconda is the leading Python distribution. So what's Microsoft doing here? They're trying to get their tools like Visual Studio and Visual Studio Code in the hands of more data scientists and not just app developers. The way they're trying to do that is by bundling it in with this Python distribution. So if you go and get Anaconda now, you will get VS Code, which is pretty interesting and pretty cool. I think it's effective immediately. And it's just part of the distribution, no charge or anything. Just you can just go get it, and there it is. And there are some special features built in for Anaconda users specifically. So we were talking AI earlier. There you go.
Anaconda is Python for data scientists.
Yes.
Gives you all this, you know, SciPy, TensorFlow, SciKit. cool. Very cool.
Yes.
And now, and now, without further ado, let's get Cody. Let's get our code name pick of the week.
I need you guys to help me piece this together. You guys, meaning you two and anyone listening to the show right now.
All yous guys.
There's a code name called ProjFS. P-R-O-J-F-S. Not WinFS. ProjFS. The Walking Cat found this thing. Huh. And we think it's this thing that some people have been seeing in some of the latest Windows 10 builds that's called Windows Projected File System. Walking Cat thinks this is the same thing as GVFS, which is the Git Virtual File System. So the question is, why is there this thing called Projected File System coming in Windows 10? Like, who is it for and what is it? You know, Git. The GVFS was the virtualization of the file system for Git repos. So why is this in Windows 10, and who's it aiming to do something for? So I have a lot of questions.
It's a superset.
It's going to be a superset, right?
That's what I'm thinking. Like that it's going to project different file systems, not just Git.
Oh, yeah, maybe. So who would that be for, and what would you do with that?
Yeah, like what else would be like that, you mean?
Yeah.
So it's not project, it's projected.
It's projected file system.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you ask Microsoft about it, they're like, you know what? We're testing a lot of things in Windows 10 that we're not ready to talk about. Wow.
it's REFS 2.0.
It's WinFS, back from the grave.
Yeah. WinFS, yeah.
Well, I think while we ponder this great mystery, we should all have a beer.
I think we should. And let's have a really big beer.
A big beer.
Yes. So Revolution Brewing, Chicago. They make a lot of nice light beers. They also make a very big imperial stout called Cafe Death.
This is not a Pilsner, is it?
It is not a Pilsner.
It's not a wheat beer.
0.8, I think, percent coffee imperial stout.
Oh, and wow. Sounds great.
You know what? some people say all coffee imperial stouts are the same. They are not. This one is so just great. It's like having the best cup of coffee you ever had, except it's a beer and it's 14.8%.
So it'll make you sleepy.
It will make you sleepy, even though it's coffee. And the coolest thing, it's coming in small, regular size cans now. I've seen some of the cans here in New York. So, you know, you can go get your death in a can.
Yep.
And it's very tasty.
Death is spelled the same way as Megadeth spells it.
Yes.
D-E-T-H.
Right. Not death as you may think.
Right. Is it smooth?
Very. Oh, man. It's so good.
Smooth going
I had
down.
It as part of an Imperial Stout tasting, and it was one of the favorites.
Sounds really good.
Very delicious.
Sounds really good. Coffee beer.
Coffee beer.
When I was growing up, I drank coffee milk, and now I'm going to be drinking coffee beer.
Yep.
There we go. That's it. That's the entire rundown. Every little bit of it, all in one. I'm going off to buy the $20 Age of Empires definitive edition. That's a good deal.
I didn't think we were going to get through everything today.
I know.
Me neither.
So loaded with goodness. We do this show every Wednesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. If you want to stop by, you can watch it live, either on our live stream, which is, of course, twit.tv/live, or in studio. And I have to say, Daniel from Washington, D.C., and Debbie from the Big Island are visiting today. Very nice to have you both.
Island meaning Long Island or Oahu?
Waikaloa.
All right, I guess this is Hawaii, isn't it? The
Hawaii.
Big Island is Hawaii.
Hawaii. Yeah. Are you on the dry side or the wet side?
Dry
side. Kona side. Very nice. She didn't look soggy. I just wanted to check. If you want to be here live in studio, you can. Just email tickets at twit.tv so we know you're coming. We don't like surprises. Well, I don't mind surprises, but Mo, our armed guard, is not a fan. He was a Marine, served in Iraq. So you don't want to surprise him. Let's just put it that way.
Yep. No surprises from Mo.
I like teasing Mo. I love Mo. He's the greatest. So if you can't watch live in studio and you can't be on the live stream, you can always join us at your leisure using the on-demand versions, whether you go to twit.tv/windows or find your favorite podcatch program and subscribe. That way you get it every week. That's the best way to do it. Thank you all for being here. One last chance to take that survey if you haven't done so. twit.tv/survey. Every year we do it once a year. We ask our audience to tell us a little bit about themselves. Helps us sell the show and carefully cultivate new shows for your delectation. We will, of course, protect your privacy. We don't want to. That's why we only do it once a year. twit.tv/survey. Thank you, Paul. Paul Thurrott is at Thurrott.com. Mary Jo Foley is at allaboutmicrosoft.com. They'll be back here next week. I hope you will, too. We'll see you next time on Windows Weekly.